From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm here for her for the next couple of weeks. When is it better to let a patient die than to treat the illness? And whose rights are more important, those of the mother or of the fetus? These are just a few of the questions Ruth Macklin helps doctors, patients, and families answer every day. She also teaches bioethics, a field spawned by the vast technological changes in medicine. On today's Fresh Air, we talk to Ruth Macklin about our mortal choices. Also, artist John Baldessari tells us why he covers pictures of people's faces with brightly colored circles. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of Handel's opera, Flavio. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. A group of U.S. diplomats who should have been able to leave Iraq were prohibited from leaving today. The State Department says Iraq is changing the conditions for the diplomats' departure. A State Department spokesman said the groups of diplomats and their families had requested permission to leave Iraq a week ago. The Baghdad government has said that U.S. diplomats are free to leave the country, but the State Department says that appears not to be the case. After delivering a pep talk to Pentagon employees, President Bush returned to his vacation home in Kennebunkport, Maine today to prepare for his meeting tomorrow with Jordan's King Hussein. NPR's Richard Gonzalez is with the president and files this report.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said King Hussein is expected to meet with the president for 1.5 to 2 hours tomorrow. Fitzwater said the administration had no information to indicate that the king is carrying a message from Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, as has been reported. When asked whether the meeting could produce a breakthrough in the Persian Gulf crisis, Fitzwater said, "We have no expectations one way or another." The spokesman said no decision has been made whether to call up reserve forces for the Middle East deployment. Fitzwater also responded to the ABC News report that the Iraqi government considers the remaining Americans in Kuwait and Iraq to be restrictees. Fitzwater said that description is nothing new, adding that the Iraqi government has not said officially that the Americans will remain in Iraq until the crisis is resolved. I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in Kennebunkport, Maine.
The aircraft carrier John F. Kennedy and its 8-ship battle group left East Coast ports today on a quickly planned deployment to the Middle East. Yesterday, the Pentagon said the Kennedy battle group and its 9,000 men may be used to replace the Eisenhower battle group in the Red Sea. The Kennedy might also be added to the naval forces already in the Middle East as part of the Desert Shield operation to defend Saudi Arabia. American troops arriving in Saudi Arabia say their biggest concern is Iraqi chemical weapons. Today, a high-ranking Saudi military official attempted to calm those fears. NPR's John Itzde reports from Saudi Arabia.
General Turki bin Nasser, commander of a large Saudi airbase, believes the chemical threat is exaggerated. If Iraq tried to deliver chemical bombs with airplanes, the general says the sophisticated Saudi air defense system would shoot them down. As for Iraq's Soviet-made Scud missiles, which might carry chemical warheads, the general says their guidance systems are so crude that the missiles are likely to miss their targets and instead land in the empty desert or open sea. The only other alternative, Iraqi artillery, will only reach a few miles into Saudi territory. I'm John Itzde reporting from Saudi Arabia.
India has successfully test-fired a new surface-to-air missile. A report from an Indian news agency says the medium-range multi-target missile was fired from a test range along India's eastern coast. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed slightly higher. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. In 1971, a new term entered the language, bioethics. This new field of philosophy deals with the ethical questions that arise in the practice of medicine and human biology. My guest, Dr. Ruth Macklin, is a pioneer in the field. She was part of the first team of philosophy professors to teach a course in bioethics in the early 70s and work in hospitals with physicians to help guide them in their work. Raising questions of ethics seemed unnecessary in the field of medicine, a profession assumed to be ethical by its very nature, but new technologies have changed medicine and create a new layer of uncertainties. Amniocentesis, life-prolonging equipment, surrogate motherhood raise questions about the right to die, allocation of scarce resources, and the rights of a mother and her fetus. The need to discuss these issues has led some hospitals to create a staff position for an ethicist. Ruth Macklin is the ethicist in residence at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and its affiliated hospitals in New York City. Macklin is also the author of several books, including her most recent, Mortal Choices, Ethical Dilemmas in Modern Medicine. I asked Ruth Macklin how the doctors react to her presence as an ethicist in their hospital.
I think that requires both a little bit of elaboration on what I do, which is not give answers so much as help doctors think things through, provide an ethical analysis, try to clarify and structure the ethical problems that they confront. But I don't come in knocking on the door of physicians or other health professionals and say, here I am, I'm your ethicist, I'm here to solve your problems. In fact, I believe that if thoughtful people, professionals who devote their life to the profession and who do want to do the right thing, if they're unable to come up with clear right answers, then there are no clear right answers. So as far as my coming in and thinking I know the answers where doctors don't, that really doesn't describe quite accurately what I do. Doctors are puzzled very often, and they're not sure what the ethical problem is. They disagree with a colleague, and they may end up in a shouting match saying, well, that's your opinion, or that's my opinion, or that's what you learned from your religion, and they can't talk anymore. One of the things that we who think and write and do research in this field are able to do is to try to come up with some ethical principles that apply and to try to indicate wherein lies the ethical problem.
Well, the ethical problems in medicine nowadays are rampant as the technology continues to expand. So in whose interests do you actually work?
I hope I work in the patient's interest. And what I mean by that is not that patients and doctors are often or always adversaries, but what much of this field of bioethics and the movement that underpins it is about is empowering patients. Now, what I mean here is that sometimes a patient may wish to refuse or forego a treatment, or a family may seek to do so on behalf of a patient who's no longer capable of speaking for himself or herself. Doctors may be in a quandary, either thinking that they have an obligation to treat because that's what medicine, their training taught them, or they may be fearful of some unnamed, unknown, unenvisaged legal liability. Hospitals, for their part, and by that I mean hospital administrators, are paranoid, virtually paranoid, that some malpractice suit's going to come out of the woodwork or that some prosecutor, some zealous prosecutor, is hovering about waiting to swoop in whenever a plug gets pulled. So in advocating for the patient, or if you will, in acting in the interest of the patient, I and most of my colleagues look at this array of forces and interests operating and ask, what's best for the patient?
How do you advise in a situation where there's a conflict between the health of the mother and the health of the fetus, and one has to be saved, or only one can be saved? Has this condition shown up in your experience?
Well, I think you have to be a little more specific. I mean, it's not like it was generations ago when in childbirth, for example, the choice was often between the life of the mother or the life of the emerging infant. Today, it's rare that it's the life of the mother versus the life of the fetus. But it may be, and it actually frequently is, a pregnant woman who refuses a recommended medical procedure of some sort that is judged to be for the benefit of the fetus. And it's not a choice between her life or the life of the fetus, but it is a choice between her right to informed consent and informed refusal and the medical interests of the fetus. So that's usually the conflict. A couple of quick examples. It could be a cesarean section, quite common these days, because they can do a lot of fetal monitoring, and that when fetal distress of some sort is identified by fetal monitoring, it may be that the physician recommends a cesarean section. The woman may refuse because she doesn't want to have the surgery. A cesarean section, a birth by cesarean section, places the woman at about a fourfold increased risk of death during childbirth. So a woman may refuse for rational reasons. Sometimes women refuse cesarean sections for religious reasons. They're opposed to cutting. And sometimes it's just simple fear. there are other circumstances as well. Sometimes a woman needs a blood transfusion. If she's a Jehovah's Witness, she may refuse the blood transfusion for herself, even though she may be putting her own life at risk as well as that of her fetus. And there may are a variety of other circumstances. For example, a pregnant diabetic woman who may be non-compliant on her insulin or other recommended medications may risk the life or health of the fetus. Now, I didn't yet answer you which side I come down on, but I will. It's a troubling and, indeed, these days, unpopular position, but I believe in the rights of autonomous adults. Pregnant women are autonomous adults, just like non-pregnant women and non-pregnant men. Therefore, the rights of a woman to refuse a medical treatment, I argue, should extend even to the time when she's pregnant, and even if it might risk the health or the life of her fetus.
This notion of autonomy of the patient seems relatively recent. In part, it goes along with the assumption that the patient is going to be informed about what has to be done.
That's right.
I mean, sometimes doctors just operated without telling the patient what was involved.
That's right. And in fact, the notion of autonomy as we speak of it today in the field of bioethics is a relatively new notion. However, the ethical and indeed legal requirement that physicians not only inform a patient but get consent or permission before performing a surgical procedure goes back to a case, Schlondorf versus New York Hospital, all the way back in the first decades or so of this century. I think it was 1912 or 1913 that case was first argued. And what the ruling was in that case is that a doctor who cuts into a patient, essentially performs a surgical procedure without the patient's consent, is guilty of assault. However, it wasn't until the late 1950s and more recently that there was a legal requirement that patients had to be informed, not just get their permission, but inform them about the nature of what would be done, the procedures, the risks and the benefits, and any alternatives they may have. So the notion of informed consent is relatively recent. And beyond that, the concept of autonomy that you just mentioned really is goes hand in hand with the modern movement in bioethics, which was essentially granting patients rights of self-determination.
When a choice needs to be made, when a patient is, say, under anesthesia and cannot be informed, I mean, is this when you step into the operating room or a lawyer steps in to act for the patient, or does the doctor then have to make a judgment at that time?
Yeah, I think you're probably talking about an emergency then. I mean, if it's in the operating room, I go into the operating room is when I need surgery on myself. And lawyers have no place in the operating room because what do they know? In fact, an emergency, whether it be in the operating room, in the emergency room of a hospital, or on the wards of the hospital when an emergency arises, the emergency is actually the only situation that does not require informed consent. There, the doctor uses his best clinical judgment, acts first, and asks philosophical questions later, and that's as it should be.
Say a doctor opens up a patient and discovers that there are a couple of clumps of cancer in different places and did not plan to operate for cancer but takes the cancer out anyway. Is that an example of an emergency, or is that an example of a doctor exceeding what is assumed a doctor should exceed nowadays?
Well, what did he open her up for?
Well, I'm trying to remember. You actually had an example in your book.
Yes, I did. It was a minor surgical procedure. And in the course of taking out an organ or a damaged organ or doing a minor procedure, the doctor notices that the patient has cancer. And in that episode, the doctor reasoned it was in the patient's best interest to have the cancer taken out because the risks of anesthesia and of undergoing the surgical procedure a second time outweighed, in the doctor's balancing of these, outweighed any benefits to the patient.
This was a patient in his or her 70s, is that
yes, recall? Yes, yeah. An older patient, mm-hmm. And it's always riskier with an older patient. I mean, I think what the doctor did in that case was not terribly wrong because it was benefiting the patient by removing the cancer, but it did violate the precept of informed consent. And if we take principles like that seriously, doctors cannot rely on what they long relied on, which is presumed consent. There is no presumed consent. The patient has to be asked and give informed permission each time a new procedure is done.
My guest is Dr. Ruth Macklin. She's the ethicist in residence at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and its affiliated hospitals in New York City. She's written a book about her field called Mortal Choices. Say you have a baby that's born with spina bifida and has a prognosis of a very painful life if a neonatologist is able to resuscitate and keep the child alive so that it's able to thrive for a while. What are some of the debates? What are some of the issues that get discussed? I assume there's the doctor urging mm-hmm. to keep the child alive. There might be parents saying, let's let the child die an early death because it would be too painful to live with.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the natures? What are some of the positions that come up in a case like that?
Well, at one position, at one extreme, and I'll give several extremes and then name the principles. One extreme is virtually a right to life position, which is to say no one can or should make judgments about quality of life. Let me not call it right to life, but sanctity of life. It's sometimes called a vitalist position. And according to that view, neither the parents nor the doctors nor ethicists nor anyone should have the authority to decide that an infant who can live and may live a life that has some pain and suffering, no one should have the authority to decide that no life is better than some life. Now, at an extreme position, whether with spina bifida or some other condition, that position says always treat. You never have the option of not treating or of treating less aggressively, which is the words physicians use. At another extreme is the view that the parents ought to decide. It's their child. They're the ones who have to rear it. They're the ones who'll have responsibility, moral, financial, emotional, and so they should decide, and whatever they decide is what ought to be done. That position essentially says there's no right answer, but the only right answer is who decides, and it's the parent. The view that I take, and a lot of my colleagues take, is essentially a patient-centered or infant-centered view. And we presume that the parents are the decision makers for their newborn, unless they're making a decision that's clearly against the best interest of the infant. Not just possibly against, but clearly against the infant's best interest. That, of course, requires that we try to define what's the infant's best interest. And that's not easy because that's the very point that's under debate here. Is it in the infant's best interest to continue life? I and very many of my colleagues come down in cases of spina bifida on the side of life, largely because when you look at children and even adults who have that affliction, they live meaningful lives. They can work. They go to school. Many are highly educated. And given a life that can have meaning, even though it might have pain and suffering associated with it, a life that can have meaning where there's not such severe neurologic damage that the human being could not enjoy human pursuits or recognize loved ones, then with spina bifida, that always comes down on the side of life.
My guest is Dr. Ruth Macklin. She's the ethicist in residence at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and its affiliated hospitals in New York City. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Ruth Macklin. She's a bioethicist in New York City, has written a book about her field and about the kinds of decisions she helps advise on called Mortal Choices. These are cases that would try a couple, a family, to try to decide and come to any sort of resolution about. Have you had to make choices on your own for your own family in that regard?
No, not yet. We did in my family, however. Also, my mother and I signed our living wills at the same time, and we were both healthy. I mean, she's much older, and I'm middle-aged or thereabouts. And because we were both healthy and there was no imminent illness or fatal disease lurking in the background, it was actually a happy family occasion. And since I and my brother and my own two adult children were there, we kind of laughed and joked about it. But I think as far as living wills or involving family members, the best time to make those decisions is while everyone's still healthy and when everyone can communicate. What all too often happens is families have not discussed these things, and a family member becomes ill. The adult children come running when the elderly parent is there, and no one knows what the patient would have wanted. And that's really the key to decision-making in medicine, what the patient now wants, or if the patient can no longer participate, what the patient would have wanted.
Insurance companies, employers, and even the state of Oregon are now making medical decisions based on the expense of a procedure. And I believe the state of Oregon is choosing a form of medical triage, listing priorities of, you know, is it going to be better for our community, our society, to spend $250,000 on a transplant operation, or is that $250,000 going to be better spent in a prenatal care? Is this sort of lifting decisions from the world of ethics into the world of the bottom line as
yes.
far as medicine's concerned?
Yes. And what's worse, and I think that listeners should certainly be aware, what's going on in the state of Oregon is rationing for the poor. This is the state-based Medicaid program in Oregon. And what it's doing is further increasing the gap between the kind of health care that's delivered to haves and have-nots in our society. People with money can still pay. So far, we haven't yet heard of Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and the major medical carriers rationing in the same way. I mean, perhaps that's next down the line. But what the state is doing is deciding how much of the taxpayers' money should or should not go for this or that procedure. And indeed, they're rationing medical care, but not for everybody in the state of Oregon, just those who have to rely on state assistance. So there's a manifest injustice, in addition to the problems of rationing generally and looking at the bottom line rather than health care as a need. There's also this injustice of giving people unequal access to what the medical system can provide.
I'm struck by the information that patients now have and the kinds of choices that patients are able to make about their own lives. And it seems that part of your work, as I understand it, is trying to keep doctors and other people in the health profession from second-guessing what a patient wants, that you can come up with a number of ideas of prospective courses of action, and that you might be surprised by what a patient will actually want. Let me, I guess, be a little more specific here. You recount the experience of a patient who came into the hospital who was a drug addict and was accidentally given an overdose of methadone, 10 times the usual dose, suffered cardiac arrest. A physician immediately recognized what the problem was, resuscitated the patient, and then there was a dilemma about whether to tell the patient what had caused the cardiac arrest. And I wonder if you can explain the different attitudes of physicians and how you tried to bring about another point of view about what to tell the patient.
Well, it's always a problem when some error or mistake has been made. I think the traditional and standard response is, what good would it do now to tell the patient, this is a general response, not specifically in that case, what good would it do now to tell the patient that we made an error? Not only might the patient sue, and that would be a problem, but the patient would lose faith in doctors. The patient would lose confidence and would perhaps not enter hospitals in the future. You can't undo the wrong that was done or the error that was done by telling the patient, and you may only create worse harm or worse problem. Therefore, the argument is it's better not to tell. On the other side there's the argument about whether patients have a right to know, particularly when something was done that harmed them, and whether or not the rights of information in the medical center require that. In the case you referred to in the book, it was complicated by the fact that the physicians thought that, or argued, that if this patient were not told that what happened was medical error, that it was the fault of the doctors, the patient would believe, or would probably believe, that he had done it to himself. And when a patient believes that by taking an overdose or doing something and almost losing his life, that that could happen again, that may shock the patient into changing behavior very radically and no longer taking drugs or doing whatever the harmful behavior is. Well, there's another side. I mean, when I come in, I try to present all sides to these issues. But I also tried to point out in that case that the patient could have more trust in physicians if the patient knew that there was an error, but that physicians, first of all, informed the patient and then were able to recognize the wrong done and save the patient's life. So one doesn't always know. One can assume what patients may think or what people believe, but there's no way really of knowing what people will believe until one sees. I mean, people are surprising all the time.
I know people who've checked into hospitals sometimes feel that hospitals are run for the benefit of the medical profession rather than the patients, and that there's a process of depersonalization that goes on. Everyone gets in the same gown. The doctors call the patients by the first name, and the patient has to call the doctor by the formal title. And this trend of advocating patients' rights or awareness of what's going on seems to be reversing that in some way.
Well, there's some hope that it will reverse that. Unfortunately, from where I sit, I see new forces coming in, and I see doctors and patients as allies in a cause of trying to decide consensually and determine what's right for patients. What's happening now, and I think this is a very recent development, is hospitals are not so much run for the benefit of doctors as for the benefit of the hospitals and the hospital administrators. There are layers upon layers of administrators. Doctors themselves are often not empowered or authorized to make clinical decisions that they would have made and in fact did make in earlier times. There's a new occupation that infects many hospitals known as risk manager. You know that term?
I've heard the term. I think I'm sure you could explain it better than I
could. A risk manager is a person, sometimes a lawyer, but very often not a lawyer, who's there essentially to pour water on trouble, to minimize liability for the hospital, minimize the possibility that somewhere, somehow, some unnamed, unknown person will come out of the woodwork and sue the hospital and all its doctors. Furthermore, risk managers are now concerned not only about lawsuits, but they're also concerned about the image of the hospital. As they say here in New York, and you probably have a counterpart, and every city probably has its own counterpart, we don't want to see this hospital in the headlines of the New York Post tomorrow. So the concerns now are those of publicity, public relations, minimizing liability, and even where they see liability as bad publicity, in addition to the possibility, even remote possibility, of some kind of lawsuit. These are interfering with doctors' decisions, with doctors' and patients' decisions, with families' decisions, since now it's not simply a matter of doctors being able to do something. They're paralyzed into inaction and will often say, we have to call risk management. So this is the latest, and that's in fact what my next book's going to be about. The intrusion into the doctor-patient relationship by this new breed of hospital administrators, lawyers, and risk managers. They're the ones now whom the hospitals are being run for. The poor doctors are as beleaguered as the patients.
Dr. Ruth Macklin, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Dr. Ruth Macklin. She's a medical ethicist at Albert Einstein College and its affiliated hospitals in New York. Her book is called Mortal Choices. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer Diane Ackerman, author of the new bestseller, A Natural History of the Senses. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Much of the art in museums hangs in rectangular frames, lovely oils, or stands on pedestals, beautiful sculpture. But for the past few decades, artists have been using a wide range of materials, photographs, videos, text, and common household items that don't immediately say art supplies. Coming up, we meet one of the pioneers of conceptual art, John Baldessari. Also, Handel's opera Flavio is out for the first time on CD. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says this obscure recording is worth the wait. And critic Maureen Corrigan examines a new book about the ways Westerners view so-called primitive art. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iran says that it will look over the latest Iraqi peace plan with optimism, but won't comment officially for now. Under President Hussein's plan, his country said that it accepted Iran's proposal for an exchange of some 100,000 prisoners of war. The plan also calls for pulling out Iraqi troops still stationed along the joint border with Iran. President Bush meets tomorrow in Maine with King Hussein of Jordan. The U.S. effort to get American citizens out of Kuwait and Iraq remains frustrated in spite of numerous meetings between American diplomats and Iraqi authorities. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Iraqi officials now refer to the 3,000 Americans in their country and Kuwait as restrictees. State Department spokesmen say this term does not signify a worsening in the situation. They say it's just a matter of semantics. The State Department refuses to call the Americans hostages. There have been no demands made for these people, spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said today. These people are not bound and gagged. In Kuwait, electricity and water are generally available, the State Department says, though cash to buy food is becoming a problem. The U.S. Embassy there is providing small amounts of cash to Americans who can demonstrate a need. In Iraq, the State Department says movement for Americans within the city is unrestricted, except for about 38 Americans who are being kept at the Rashid Hotel by soldiers with guns at the front door. Embassy officials have been able to visit these people. Since the crisis began, the State Department in Washington has handled about 17,000 calls, primarily from anxious relatives of the Americans in Kuwait and Iraq. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Soviet President Gorbachev has revoked decrees passed by the Soviet Parliament between 1966 and 1988, which stripped exiles of their right to Soviet citizenship. Bridget Kendall of the BBC reports this action is part of a larger effort to speed up improvement of the Soviet human rights record.
The decision, said TASS, was part of a continuing process to put right injustices done to people deprived of their citizenship during this period. In June this year, President Gorbachev restored citizenship to three leading writers, expelled during the Brezhnev years, Alexander Zinoviev, Joris Medvedev, and Vladimir Maximov. And several prominent émigrés have recently returned to the Soviet Union for well-publicized cultural visits. But other leading figures, including the Nobel Prize winner Alexander Solzhenitsyn, were also expelled and stripped of their citizenship. And thousands of other émigrés, including many Soviet Jews who received permission to emigrate to Israel, also automatically lost their citizenship and right to return to the Soviet Union.
Bridget Kendall to the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than a point and only moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, I'll talk with West Coast artist John Baldessari. But first, over the past 20 years, Baroque music has become very popular. The composer Handel has been one of the major beneficiaries of this trend. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the very first recording of an early Handel opera, Flavio. Lloyd says it's an obscure work with some wonderful music.
Flavio, King of Lombardy, is one of the operas Handel produced in the early 18th century in London, where Italian operas were all the rage. It wasn't a hit. But Handel's next opera, Julius Caesar, with the same librettist, was. And as was common practice, Handel recycled some of the music from Flavio for Julius Caesar. The plot of Flavio also recycles some familiar elements. In order to avenge an insult, one character forces his son to kill his fiancé's father on his wedding day. That's one way to break an engagement. The king falls in love with a woman who is already secretly betrothed to his own staff officer. At the end, the wise King Flavio deals with everyone's problems, including his own, with wit and good grace. When he first asks his officer what he thinks of the woman he has fallen for, the officer, not wanting to give away his own passion, calls her unattractive. Then, when the king finds out whom she really loves, he commands the officer to marry that very same unattractive woman. Handel scholar Winton Dean attributes the failure and subsequent neglect of Flavio to its complex tone, its mélange of comedy and tragedy, satire and romance. Yet the music, from the height of Handel's early maturity, is infinitely attractive and powerful. Here's soprano Lena Lutens singing Handel's moving lyric lament, Ma chi punire desio. How can she punish the man she loves, even if he has killed her father? This recording was made shortly after a production of the opera at a Festival of Ancient Music in Innsbruck last year. The cast includes two fine lyric sopranos, Lena Lutens and Christina Högman as the officer. It's a male role that was written for a woman to sing. There are also excellent performances by countertenor Derek Lee Reagan, mezzo-soprano Bernarda Fink, and tenor Gianpaolo Fagotto as various other lovers and fathers. But the particular glory of the recording is Geoffrey Gall as Flavio. Gall sang the title role in Peter Sellers' extraordinary production of Julius Caesar and recently became the first countertenor ever to sing at the Met. He has a phenomenal voice, large, clear, and evenly focused throughout its extended range. Very high, of course, with a staggering coloratura technique, yet completely masculine in timbre, which isn't always the case among countertenors. Most of all, he's an expressive, vividly imaginative actor. Gall is a singer of historical significance, and this is probably his most important recording. Here he is as Flavio, suddenly aroused by his officer's girlfriend. Ha ha ha! The musicians of the Ensemble 415 play superbly under René Jacobs. His conducting is a bit restrained, yet clearly benefits from the live performances that preceded the recording. Not every rediscovered Baroque opera is a masterpiece, but Flavio is an extremely enjoyable and touching work, and this recording rescues it from oblivion. It must get the best performance since Handel's own time, maybe its best ever.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Handel's Flavio on the Harmonia Mundi label. This is Fresh Air. Found photos, images from TV and video and stills combined with some text form the basis for John Baldessari's art. He's a pioneer in the movement known as conceptual art, the manipulation of words and images from popular culture to create a new work. It's only been in the last few years that he's received national recognition and been able to quit teaching, a job he's held at CalArts for 18 years. Some of his most famous students include David Sal and Eric Fischel. The first major retrospective of Baldessari's work is now in exhibit in San Francisco. The exhibit was organized by the Los Angeles Museum of Contemporary Art and covers Baldessari's career dating back to the mid-60s. That was when Baldessari abandoned painting and began looking for new ways to do his art.
In the late 60s, I would say early 70s, I began to get, concerned that somehow I was headed in the wrong direction. And I began to stop painting. I don't think it's so much as stopping painting as enlarging the idea of what I had, I suppose, sort of culturally accepted what art was. And I began to explore photography, film, video, making artist books, that sort of thing. I think I had sort of unblinkingly accepted what I had been taught in college, and never questioned it too much, that art was basically painting or sculpture. And as I went on exploring more and more, I just got to be more concerned that that was too narrow a definition, and there must be something else out there. You know, I wasn't quite sure what it was, but I was going to, you know, fiddle around and find out what it might be.
So much about being an artist is not only how you feel about yourself as an artist, but also how others choose to recognize you. In other words, an artist who's starting out and struggling, maybe doing a lot of painting or sculpture or photo montage, but nobody is interested in acquiring the work for themselves. In other words, you don't sell anything.
Yeah. Well, when I started out, economics of art wasn't even an issue. For one thing, I didn't even know any artists. And as I began to know artists, I didn't really know anybody that was selling it. Now and then you would sell one to a relative or whatever, you know, but that would be about it. So it really didn't enter in.
Does this sort of economic value that's now in your artwork unnerve you, or does it please you? How do you react to this sort of great surge of interest in your work?
I don't think about it a lot. Mm-hmm. I've got to say, because as I said earlier, it really never was part of my life until only in the last few years, and it seems something superfluous, you know, to me, like. It hasn't internalized in any way. It's just something, you know. I mean, I don't think about it, but, you know, it's something you just contend with, like the traffic or whatever, you know. I mean, I don't think about it too much.
Some of your, I believe, is relatively current work has been large, almost mural-sized photographs of people, black and white photographs, and the faces are covered up with vinyl, it appear to be vinyl dots of some kind.
Yes.
In primary colors, blues and reds and yellows. Wonder if you could describe what you wanted to do with these paintings or photographs.
Well, yeah, they're kind of...
I don't know what to call them.
Hybrids, yeah. Yeah, no, I rather like that. Blocking out the faces in that way started some years ago, where I began to come across found photographs of people in sort of civic situations, you know, like the mayor opening up a new shopping center, or the head of a Kiwanis club, let's say, passing on the gavel to an incoming president, you know, those sorts of photographs, and, you know, sort of local politics or what have you, or local civic situations. And I couldn't identify my feelings at the time, but looking back, I think I was repelled by these photographs because I realized that this was life around me, and somehow, you know, I was sequestered in my studio and not involved with that kind of life. It's the kind of strange feeling I get when I have to, you know, go and cash a check at a bank, or, you know, or you know, go pay a ticket at the courthouse or what have you, that all of a sudden, you know, I realize that's real life. But I was attracted by the power these photographs had for me, albeit in a rather negative way, I suppose. And one day, I had these sort of circular price stickers around that I'd used in some other work, and I began to blot out the faces. And an enormous flood of relief swept over me. And somehow I'd adjusted the power situation between them and me. And but as a byproduct, I came to realize that I had changed these people from individuals, let's say, you know, Joe Smith, you know, or whatever, to the judge, you know, or the insurance broker, or what have you. And then I could begin to create restage my own scenario. So I became something like a movie director or a stage director or playwright or what have you. And I could begin to make these sort of morality plays, I suppose.
I think it sets up a lot of tension, you know, when somebody goes to a museum and tries to figure out what's going on in a painting or a photograph or a montage. We want to know a story. At least I do when I go in. And when I was looking at the black and white photographs with the dots on the faces, it was very puzzling. I didn't know what was going on. So it was good to hear this story. Does the reaction of somebody looking at your art concern you at all? Does it?
Yes, it does very much. I having taught all my life, I'm quite concerned with making contact with, you know, somebody else out there, and that there has to be communication going on. I pitch my work, I think, somewhere between, on the high end, having it so completely abstract and elusive that only, if, you know, one or two other people might get it, on one end, and on the other end, making things so unequivocally clear that nobody could not get it. So it's somewhere in the middle, and I think I do that because in teaching, I've always avoided the dogmatic approach and that saying, well, you know, I know what art is, and this is the way it's done, and this is the way it should be, and, you know, A, B, C, D. Rather, I've always sort of tried to create a situation where art might occur, you know, and this means sort of keeping things off balance all the time. Now, if a person just simply shrugs their shoulders and walks on and say, you know, I just beyond me, well, then I haven't been successful. I think what I'm trying to create is a situation that is, but you know, is open but under control at the same time. And I think that's very much like modern life, that given an event in the world, we can, you know, all of us can sort of get it, but we'll all have our own separate stories. I think it's more realistic that life is without certitude. We put meaning on situations.
The idea of a retrospective gives people who come to see your art or any artist's artwork sort of in a whole over 20, 30 years worth of work. And it's possible to see a painting, you know, within a larger context of how your ideas progress. What is your reaction when you take a look back at your work? Are you amused or amazed at some of the things you've done? Startled? Do you wish you could take some of it from the wall and hide it?
First of all, the earlier work, a lot of that stuff I haven't seen, you know, since I did it in the mid-60s. And so that's quite an unnerving moment, let's say. I mean, some of it, you know, I joked with a friend of mine, even begins to look like art, it begins to have patina. But seeing it all together, it's incredible opportunity, because ideally that's what any artist would want to do. And I remember I read about Motherwell once. He had rented out this big loft space just to put up all the work he had available, just to sit around and look at it. You know, nobody has that space. So here's a situation where you can put up, you know, all the work you've, not all of it, you know, a good selection of work you've done to date, and say, okay, here's what I've done. Now, what's good, what's bad, where might I go next, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that in itself is a great situation.
John Baldessari, thank you very much for being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
All right, thank you.
There's a retrospective exhibit of John Baldessari's work at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art until September 9th. Then the show travels to Washington, D.C., Minneapolis, and New York. This is Fresh Air. Later here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, host Linda Wertheimer has stopped by to give us a preview. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Sej. Today we have an interview with the ambassador from Iraq to this country. In part, we'll be talking about his country's offer to Iran to free political prisoners and prisoners of war. It's an offer which apparently Iraq hopes would neutralize the power of Iran in this present conflict. We're also watching the diplomatic mission of the King of Jordan. Hussein is in Washington tonight, and he will be talking to President Bush. The Pentagon is discussing the possibility of bringing up the reserves to replace troops that are going to Saudi Arabia.
A full report on All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. White Western cultures interpret so-called primitive societies in a variety of ways. You can see various judgments depending on whether you're at a museum, watching a Hollywood movie, reading a novel, or for that matter, a Banana Republic catalog. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of a new book, Gone Primitive, that explores what our vision of other cultures tells us about our own.
You probably know the old joke. The Lone Ranger and Tonto are riding the range when suddenly a tribe of Indians appears out of nowhere and surrounds them. The Lone Ranger says, "Tonto, there are Indians everywhere. What are we going to do?" And Tonto answers, "What do you mean, we, white man?" In Gone Primitive, Mariana Torgovnik says that the Lone Ranger's kind of egocentric vision characterizes the way white men have seen so-called primitive people. Primitives have been idealized as noble savages, like Friday and Robinson Crusoe, or they've been feared as irrational, lusty hordes who need to be colonized. The way Western society has seen primitives has also influenced the way it's referred to groups closer to home, that it labels as other. Women, minorities, the working class, they've all at some time been described as childlike, promiscuous, threatening, in short, primitive. What Turgovnik finds at the heart of Western culture's idea of the primitive is the horror of our own deepest obsessions about control and supremacy. I'm an old Saturday morning fan of Johnny Weissmuller's yodel and Cheetah's wit, so I was fascinated by the discussion here of the Tarzan novels and movies. When the series began in 1912, Tarzan often criticized the hierarchies of civilized society, white over black, men over women. But once he became king of the jungle, Tarzan was co-opted. In Tarzan and the Ant-Men, he discovers a matriarchal society where men are sex slaves. As this passage indicates, Tarzan swiftly reestablishes the proper order. Now each male had a woman cooking for him. To entertain Tarzan, the son of the first woman seized a woman by the hair and struck her heavily about the head. The woman fell upon her knees, her face glowing with love and admiration. Me, Tarzan, you, Tarzan's doormat. Because Tarzan and the Ant-Men was published in 1924, Turgovnik says it could represent the male backlash against American and British women who had recently won the right to vote. Gone Primitive is packed with explosive cultural and literary insights, but its most exciting chapter is the one on Freud's self-serving analysis of women and the primitive. There's Freud, a Jew living in Vienna before World War II. He wants to see himself as mainstream. The society sees him as other. So, in Civilization and Its Discontents, he projects the negative qualities of his own otherness onto women and primitive people. Turgovnik says that Freud's desperation to be mainstream even reveals itself in the furnishings of his famous study. Primitive art cluttered the room, but Freud, that great colonizer of psyches, always sat under a civilized Roman portrait head. Turgovnik says that Western society still uses the primitive to maintain psychic divisions between us and them. The myth of the primitive really comes in handy during wartime. Maybe that's why the Iraqis have suddenly begun to have an awful lot in common with Injuns and headhunters.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Mariana Turgovnik's book is called Gone Primitive. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Our office is held together by Dorothy Farabee. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, filmmaker Christian Blackwood. His new documentary, Motel, shows later this month on Public TV's POV series. Critic Owen Glaberman checks out Wild at Heart, the new film by David Lynch. And rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about dancehall reggae. That and more next time on Fresh Air.